ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's just your average suburb, but there's a whiff of someone playing silly duckers. Reg Grundy's kids' clothes and stuffed toys are going missing.
It's Leonardo da Vinci.
Hi, I'm Dr. Anne Jones, and I've secured an interview with Leonardo da Vinci, the criminal cat, thieving mastermind, for my podcast series, Nature's Most Wanted.
What the duck?
On ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer stands up to President Trump's missives about how he could run his country better,
it's clear the fortunes of Britain and its Prime Minister are less assured. Keir Starmer's fed up with both Trump and Putin.
Brexit, COVID, and changing global winds have hit Britain hard.
And the war in Iran is exposing its precarious position in a new global order.
With some of the most expensive energy in the world and a depleted defence force,
will this fallen empire be able to rise again in any shape or form? I'm Geraldine Duke.
And I'm Latika Burke. Welcome to Global Roaming.
Now, you're living there in the UK, Latika. We're hearing that there's a political earthquake beckoning there because they've got all these local elections in about 3 weeks' time, 136 local authorities. And the view is that Labour is really going to be wiped out, like akin to its wipeout in 1931. Now, does it feel like that?
Yes, but there are some shifting dials here. One of them is Monsieur Trump over the pond. The special relationship is breaking up a little, but oddly enough, Geraldine, that's actually favouring Keir Starmer. He took an early decision, unlike Anthony Albanese, by the way, to oppose this war in Iran, and it seems to be paying off handsomely for him, even though it has exposed a lot of problems with Britain's defences and so on.
Now, you know, the reason why we're taking note here in Australia of British defence spending, not something that would have been top of mind before relatively recent times, is because we're expecting a British submarine, a British-Australian-American submarine to be built as part of the AUKUS deal. So it's a very important delivery that is expected in the 2030s.
Yeah, and this is a good moment to stocktake. When I moved here in 2016, we did not talk about the UK as a security relationship, did we? We talked about it, if anything, as a people-to-people relationship and something a little of the past, maybe. Now, of course, we talk about the UK as though it's a security partnership or even an alliance. So things have really changed in our bilateral relationship, but so too has the UK's relationships in its own security landscape, and not for the better, Geraldine. NATO really is in question in a way we have never seen before, and the UK is not prepared for this moment.
Well, I'll let you introduce our guest because, as I said, you're all there together in London. Lucky you.
James Crabtree, a delight to welcome him to the program. He's a geopolitical analyst and author with extensive experience living and working in Asia. He's also worked as an advisor to Prime Ministers Gordon Brown and Tony Blair. And I think this makes him uniquely placed, Geraldine, to join us on Global Roaming to talk about his views on how Britain in the world is changing, how the Iran war is exposing Britain's precarious position, but more importantly, what's the way forward or out? Here he is now.
James Crabtree, welcome to Global Roaming.
Hi, Geraldine. Great to be here.
Now, James, there's a lot of writing that a lot of us here in Australia read about British domestic politics, and there's certainly been a great deal of misery on display with this sense that Britain is going backwards at a fast rate. As somebody who's lived in Asia for quite a few years, you're now back in London, does it feel like that, that there's a Britain in decline?
So the local elections in the United Kingdom, which are going to happen in May, are going to be absolutely disastrous for the government. And so the basic question is when, not if, as in nobody thinks that Prime Minister Starmer is going to last until the next election. And the question is, will there be a Australian ALP style coup immediately after the elections, in the manner of your sort of Rudd-Gillard years, or will the Prime Minister sort of stagger on for a period of time, which could be, you know, 6 months or a year? And so the Westminster Village is absolutely kind of rife with speculation. I would say the conventional wisdom at the moment amongst the kind of the chattering classes is that the Prime Minister will survive, mostly because the sort of contenders for the crown are all in a kind of weakened position. And most people think that the person, you know, the old cliche, the person who wields the knife will not wear the crown. So there's a problem that if you are seen to be the principal plotter, then you're unlikely to become the leader. And so there's and also it's much, much more difficult for the Labour Party to topple a leader either than our Conservative Party in their periods of fratricide, or your ALP in your periods in which you swap Prime Minister every 6 months. So in that sense, and Iran is sort of moderately helpful to the Prime Minister as well, as in, you know, don't go changing your Prime Minister at a time of, you know, real global crisis. So I think probably narrow odds are that the Prime Minister will kind of stagger on for another, you know, 6 months or a year, but it's hard to say. These election results are going to be really catastrophic for the Labour Party. And although everybody expects that, there's sort of something that happens when it actually happens, if you see what I mean, as in everybody knows it's going to be terrible. But when it actually is terrible, and the true terribleness of it, you know, when the Labour Party loses councils in London that they have held for generations, when it loses power in Wales, when Reform win, you know, a gazillion seats, then the Parliamentary Labour Party is going to absolutely panic. And in that febrile moment, it's hard to tell what might happen.
So, James, last week you and I were at the London Defence Conference, which I know you had a hand in organising, and it was a very good forum. One of the things that struck me was how many people in Britain were quietly saying the worrying bit out loud, how much the world situation has deteriorated and whether NATO is still good. What is your perception of where the UK government falls on this question?
I mean, I think it's a very dangerous moment for NATO. You know, sort of fundamentally, this is all about Article 5, so that the part of NATO, the Common Defence Corps, you know, we, if one is attacked, then all are attacked. And basically, does that still stand? And so, you know, we're not going to find out until it gets tested. But the greater the perception that that Trump is not kind of seriously in NATO, the greater the incentive there is for Vladimir Putin to try and test that. And, you know, NATO's predicament is very complicated. You know, we've already had one major crisis within the NATO alliance this year in Greenland. I was in Copenhagen about 3-4 weeks ago, and there was an audible sense of relief that Trump had managed to execute a, you know, 9-hour long State of the Union or however long it was, and he hadn't mentioned Greenland once. And there was a sort of sense of, like, at least for now, you know, breathe a sigh of relief. But, you know, Iran has clearly been very damaging for NATO because, you know, the president is very angry with, principally with the United Kingdom, I think, because it's the country that you know best, and you sort of expected that Britain would be more supportive, but also other NATO allies, you know, sort of complicated also for Australia and Japan and so on, but much more so for NATO. So yeah, it's very complicated. You know, I think this is now a permanent condition for the alliance.
We're talking to geopolitical analyst and author James Crabtree about how the Iran war has exposed an already fractured Britain and if there's a way to save this entity which has been so important in Australian life.
James, what is your perception of how deeply the UK government grasps this, and in particular in comparison to how some governments in Europe are treating the state of NATO right now?
I mean, I think the United Kingdom, along with the Northern European countries, so the London Defence Conference sort of gathers, the heart of the gathering is Northern European, so the United Kingdom, the Baltic, Scandinavia, and I think all of those countries have traditionally been much more pro-American than, for instance, France has been. And therefore, they're much, much more focused on keeping the Americans on board and are willing to make kind of, you know, compromises, bite your tongue. They're willing to engage in an awful lot of strategic self-abasement because, you know, I mean, the predicament, as I say, I think Europe's position, I mean, I said I'm optimistic about the United Kingdom. I'm also very optimistic about Europe's long-term position. I would much rather be Europe than Japan or Australia. Because in the end...
Why?
Well, I mean, Donald Tusk had a lovely line about this, as in he said, you know, it's completely absurd that 500 million Europeans are going on bended knee to 320 million Americans to save them from 120 million Russians. In the end, we can handle the Russians. We've got nuclear weapons. We're much, much richer. We're much bigger. We've got six powerful middle power militaries, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Poland, Ukraine, and Turkey. And so within NATO, in the medium term, even without the Americans, you know, Europe totally should have Russia, no problem. It's just we need 10 years to get our act together because we've been so dependent on the United States. And so in a sense, our future is in our own hands. As long as we can get through this 5-10 year transition in which we're able to rearm. I think what I would say to be broadly positive about our strategic elite is that the United Kingdom would very much like to spend 3.5-4% of its GDP on its military, as in it understands the threat mostly, unlike, for instance, a country like Spain or Italy. You know, there are strategic elites in Europe which do not kind of comprehend the problem that we have. So that's good. You know, broadly speaking, I think there is an elite consensus. The question is, we don't have enough money, as in the public finances are a mess because of the backlog after the crisis and COVID and all the rest of it. And we don't know how to do it and win elections, as in, you know, if you're going to spend more on the military and that means spending less on the health service, then, you know, then you're going to lose elections. And so there's a sort of fundamental political problem, which is there is the only country in Europe, really, I mean, Poland, but particularly Germany. Germany has a fiscal position which allows it both to kind of maintain its European model for now and spend a lot more on defense. But Britain and France aren't in that position. Britain also has a nuclear deterrent, which is incredibly expensive, you know, more expensive than France's. And therefore, if you're going to keep a nuclear deterrent and that gobbles up a huge proportion of your military budget, and you do need a military deterrent, a nuclear deterrent at the moment, then that means there's proportionately less left over for, you know, sort of missile defense and all the rest of it. So, yeah, I mean, Britain has a big, big problem in terms of how do we get to 3-3.5%. Our military is not in a good position. Successive governments are to blame for that. And so the London Defence Conference that Latika attended and that, as you say, I helped to run, that was a major theme, which is how on earth do we get from where we are to where we need to be, given the pressing problem of, A, the threat from Putin and the fact that the Americans might walk out on us sooner than we ideally, you know, we want them to stay in, you know, we want them to stay in, as in, you know, we want to get to a position in which the US sort of dials back in Europe, but doesn't disappear entirely and is a kind of, you know, stakeholder in the European security order. The risk is that, particularly under Trump, that at some point they just sort of say, well, screw this, we're off. And then we're left in a position where we would really struggle collectively to manage a Russian threat without American help. We're sort of hoping that in the end, a mixture of sort of strategic self-abasement and kind of canny diplomacy and muddling through will get us to where we need to be in terms of collective European defense. And we sort of, I think the real challenge is going to come sort of next year, as in when there is some peace in Ukraine, then you have a Russian, you know, a Russian war machine that now is no longer fighting in Ukraine because there's a ceasefire of one form or another, then that's really risky because then, you know, you've now got Russia, which is spending 10% of GDP, has a massive military. And if not now, when, you know, under which future American president is it going to be better for Putin to try something in the Baltics or in the high north? You know, I mean, I think that's really, it's not quite now, but next year, the year after, before Trump goes, then I think there's a real window of danger for Europe that we have to kind of grapple with. So
does it frighten you, this prospect you're describing?
Yeah, no, it terrifies me.
I mean, has it got overtones of the 30s?
No, I mean, I think we're in a moment in which, you know, it's almost become kind of my inbox every day around Iran. You know, we'll have somebody speculating about, are we in the early stages of a world war? I think it reminds me less of the 30s and more of the run into the First World War, as in if you read, there's a magnificent book called Sleepwalkers by
Australian
historian, exactly. And that, if you look at what happened in sort of 1914, then you had a very similar situation of just sort of instability mixed with sort of complex alliances, which can can get out of hand in a way that nobody really intends. And it is, the point is often made that, you know, the two world wars didn't start, you know, with a bang. They sort of built up gradually as one conflict sort of fed off another. And so I'm much more worried about a kind of a sleepwalkers scenario in which you now have three very unstable regions with the potential for conflict of one form or another in, you know, the European Eastern flank, the Middle East and the Indo-Pacific along the first island chain. And, you know, I think, yeah, this is a very, very dangerous moment. I think we will have to be quite lucky and have good leadership to get through this. And it's a sort of cliche to say it's a feature, not a bug, but I don't think this is going away. I mean, I think we are going to need to be lucky for many decades in order to kind of get to a more stable equilibrium, given the global power shift that is kind of underway with China and subsequently India and all the rest of it, you know. And so for we Westerners, the kind of rump of the sort of liberal rules-based order that is kind of crumbling, of which Brits and Australians are sort of part, then, you know, this is a squeaky bum time, as we say in the United Kingdom.
James, we're coming up to the 10-year anniversary of the Brexit referendum. Do you think there is a deep sense of regret in the British society and that given all that's happened, they wish they were back in the European Union and this is something they might pursue or not?
I think a slight sense of regret, and no, I don't think it's likely. I think the only scenario in which I foresee Britain rejoining the European Union is a disaster, as in I think a kind of Overton window shifting, Putin does something in Lithuania, you know, holy crap, we really are in trouble. And that's a kind of sort of Churchill in the Second World War talking about a European. I think it would take that kind of external shock. Keir Starmer gave a speech, 10 days ago? Can't remember when it was, Latika, in which he talked about a kind of British pivot to Europe. But I just have very little confidence in that, partly because this number 10 operation is sort of too weak to execute it. But, you know, they can't even figure out how to do very basic things between the Europe and UK level. And so the notion that there's going to be a kind of grand realignment, I think, is just too difficult, at least in the short to medium term. I mean, in 20, 30 years' time, who knows? But within the course of this parliament and the next, I don't see a Labour government or a future Labour-led coalition government of the left going into this government with a manifesto commitment to rejoin the European Union. I just don't see that happening.
You've lived for years now in Asia, in Singapore, yeah, certainly not a place in terminal decline. What's it like moving back to the UK? Do you feel that you clearly don't feel it's in decline? You've actually got a bit of optimism. I'll tell you what, I haven't heard much of that lately.
I think there are two different things that you can say here. So Britain is in decline, but then so is Australia on the same measure, right? In terms of relative global power, then we Western sort of middle powers are all in decline. And so it's just a sort of question of how much are we declining relative to, you know, India and Indonesia and China and whoever. So absolutely we're declining. You know, this is the new world of sort of middle powers. And the United Kingdom has had a rougher period than most. We've made a lot of silly decisions that I wouldn't have supported. But I think the basic question is, in the new world that we're going into, a world in which kind of middle powers have to live on their wits and have to grow stronger, is there anything kind of fundamental about the United Kingdom which means that we're worse off than everybody else? And I look around at France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Korea, Japan. I don't see a bunch of countries that are doing brilliantly better than we are, as in I see they all, you know, I'd much rather have Britain's demographics than Japan's, much rather have our universities than yours, I'd much rather have our technology sector than anybody else's outside of the United States or China. I think, you know, there's a whole bunch of advantages that, you know, I'd much rather have London, which is the greatest city in the world, than anybody else's city. And so I think Britain has huge assets. And I think, you know, we made some bad decisions. We have real challenges in terms of our fiscal position, the functioning of the state. You know, I'm not denying any of that, but I don't think any of that is absolutely sort of disastrous and forever. You know, Britain went through periods before in the 1970s and then it recovered. Australia has also had periods where it's been in the doldrums. So I don't think there's anything sort of fundamentally structural. And actually, the United Kingdom over the course of its history has been quite good at, you know, being a sort of buccaneering power that made its way in the world, was able to make the weather. And I think we just need to rediscover some of that spirit. I'm optimistic. I mean, I don't see there's any reason at all why the United Kingdom can't prosper in the world that we're moving into, even if it's a world that for countries like Australia and the United Kingdom is going to be much, much more difficult than the world that we grew up in.
Even though, just final question, we've had some very good commentary here from Cos Samaras, who's a very good pollster, I think, in Australia and commentator, that there's a new spirit abroad that he sees as fundamentally sort of harking back to many years ago, maybe the 30s, which is a sort of a rage, a discontent that unless leaders dignify people's grievance, they'll be marked down. And this is not just a little thing. This is a significant shift, particularly among young people, and afflicting all of us, but particularly Britain, particularly us. Now, do you see that type of spirit abroad?
Definitely. I mean, as I say, I mean, why is Keir Starmer less popular than Liz Truss when he's manifestly a much better leader of the United Kingdom than Liz Truss? Why is he less popular than Boris Johnson, who, although he was a sort of charming guy, was not a fit person to be a leader of the United Kingdom? It's because people are incredibly angry. And so despite my optimism, I mean, I think there is a very dark and pessimistic scenario, not just for the United Kingdom and or Europe, which is, you know, it's plausible that by 2029, you could have most of the major countries in Europe led by new right parties, as in it is possible that Nigel Farage can be prime minister. It's very possible that Jordan Bardella can be prime minister of France. I don't think it's possible that the AfD can take over in Germany. I think sort of structurally that's too far. But you know, it is possible that you could have a dramatically different change in the next few years in terms of the kind of politics of Europe, in which the sort of governing liberal technocratic consensus is blown away by populists. So I don't discount that. I think it's possible. I don't think it's preordained. But I think we stand at a very dangerous moment, both geopolitically in terms of the position of Europe with respect to NATO, with respect to Russia, and in the long term with respect to China. But also we have, you know, a real challenge in terms of proving to the public that the kind of people who are, you know, leaders, listeners of your podcast, and kind of people who have been running our country, sort of, you know, reasonably liberal, technocratic centrists, have answers to the challenges of the current moment. And if we don't, then the public are going to look elsewhere for answers. And we know where that ends up. It doesn't end up in a good place, but it's sort of understandable that the public will look. If the people who have been running things and perceived to be making a mess of everything, it's kind of understandable that the public think, well, we might as well let the other guys have a go. And we need to be, you know, there is a risk that that will happen, and we need to kind of act decisively to make sure that it doesn't.
James Crabtree, always marvellous to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you, Geraldine. Thank you, Latika.
Thanks, James. Geraldine, I like James a lot and I value and rate his analysis, but I think he's a little too Pollyanna on the state of things in Britain, I have to say. Yes.
It's not what you feel sitting there?
I think, well, what he has missed is a couple of things. One, I would say, and you can't ever measure this, but the joy has been sapped out of London. And that is a bit of a post-Brexit, post-COVID, but also don't discount the impact of Labour going after the big spenders in this town, what that's done. A lot of them have moved offshore, and there's good data to show this, and no one denies that. And it has just led to a bit of a sapping in the mood here. The other thing I would say that is really overlooked, and this is the big story, and it's really driving a lot of support for Nigel Farage, is crime. Petty crime in this city is absolutely enormous. It's not physical crime. So it's very true to say I go out in London, I'll come home at 2, 3 a.m., whatever time, I never feel unsafe. But what you do have is everybody snatching your phone out of your hands. This happened to me 2 weeks ago. Everyone I know has had their phone snatched by a kid on a bike. And the police, when you call them, they've started to try and crack down on this now. But when you called them, they'll just give the insurance number and hang up, close your case. Even though these phones have tracking and you could call up the police and say, I know where my phone is, they won't go and get it. So that's really led to an explosion in petty crime here. That's led to bike theft, it's led to burglaries, and the data is there. A phone in London gets snatched one in every 6 or 7 minutes out of someone's hands. So it is a really huge deal. That has a very, very corrosive effect on trust in society and
on morale
and belief that the government and the system is working for you. And that's really what a lot of this populism is feeding into. And I don't think you can talk about London and the state of Britain without acknowledging that, because it's a huge deal.
I've noticed there's some interesting people like David Miliband, the man who probably should have been leading Labour, writing recently, look, we've got to stop a politics based primarily on critique, and we've got to start thinking what is needed to turn the ship of state around. Mm. I notice other sort of, you know, luminaries like John Bew, Professor of History at King's College London, saying, please let's not give up on Britain. So, you know, I think that in a way he was channeling that, but the question is whether there's, I mean, often the UK reacts after a total drama, as he said, and maybe it's not there yet. Maybe it'll be delivered by Iran, but maybe it's not quite there yet, and they're sort of muddling through, which is not a pretty look.
That is what I agreed with him most about, that the city will rebound, the country will rebound, and it has this long, centuries-old tradition of buccaneering and making it its way. It's just not there yet. I do agree with him that fundamentally this country knows how to operate when the times call. It's just that we've never had a world quite so dangerous and involving a Chinese threat. And I think he was right to paint that picture. What if all these theatres come into play? Britain's definitely not ready there, and it's not had experience of that in the past.
Okay, well, let's leave it at that point, slightly up in the end. Let's go to some feedback, because we've already had some terrific feedback from our show together earlier in the week. This is from Phil Graham. I enjoy all global episodes, but found the Rana Mehta interview even more interesting than usual. As an economist and investment manager, I have long felt the China-Taiwan standoff to be the single biggest risk for Australia and the world. As our biggest trading partner by far, and with our US military ties, any China invasion would be monumental for Australia. I think he means of Taiwan, not us. Yet, as Rana Mehta notes, China's strategy is long-term, and an invasion is not inevitable, as surely they would appreciate the risks of their economy. The recent talks with the Taiwanese opposition leader, after which I might add they reopened flights to Taipei, those talks are very interesting and highlight the many strands to their approach to Taiwan, including military build-up and increasing grey zone tactics. On the Iran situation, China's long-term approach is arguably a strong point, given Trump's yo-yo approach to strategy, if you can even call it strategy.
I agree with this feedback. I've always thought that the way to get Taiwan is strangulation, because we don't know necessarily what to do then. It doesn't activate a response necessarily from us. And yet China could achieve its goals very quietly. I think that's a very, very sage and astute piece of feedback. Thank you, Phil.
So thank you very much indeed. We really love the feedback. Now, our email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Thanks to our producers, Aston Brown, and our executive producer, Kylie Gray. Now, on Monday, Hamish and I will be back with the very first episode of a new series we're running on Mondays, Indonesia Rising, where Hamish interviews the economist Mari Pangestu, who's the former president of the World Bank, and she's a special advisor on trade to President Prabowo Subianto, talking about the transformation of the Indonesian economy. Hamish was very excited about all that he was seeing. So look, don't miss that. And goodbye from me, Geraldine Doogue. Bye-bye, Latika.
And from me, Latika Burke. See you, Geraldine.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.